Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to the Trial Lawyer View podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to have Bill Hauser. Bill is the dynamic CEO of SMB Team. Bill founded SMB Team in 2018 and has since propelled it to incredible success, working with over 600 of North America's fastest growing law firms. Through their innovative law firm growth acceleration model, SMB Team has helped clients achieve an average revenue growth of 81% in the past year. Under Bill's leadership, the firm has been recognized on the Inc. 5000 list of fastest growing companies. Before diving into the world of business and digital marketing, Bill's life was filled with high octane pursuits, from competitive dirt bike racing to performing as lead singer in punk rock bands. Motivated by his family's financial struggles during the 2008 recession, Bill shifted his focus to building resilient, recession-proof businesses. In addition to his professional achievements, Bill is a passionate practitioner of mindfulness. Today, we will explore how Bill and SMB Team unlock revenue growth for personal injury law firms with the Law Firm Growth Accelerator model outlined in his forthcoming book of the same title. Bill, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to Trial Lawyer View.
I'm excited about this. This is all I do, as I was telling you before the show, you know, injury lawyer marketing, marketing for every practice area, and quite frankly, law firm growth is where I've spent the majority of my life. So I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah, and you know, it's great because I think our audience is going to eat up what you've got to talk about, because when we talk about these things on the podcast, it speaks to this idea of running your law firm like a business, with metrics and with a plan. And all the things that I came across in doing my research for the podcast was like, hell yeah, what Bill's got to talk about are things that every personal injury law firm can get a benefit from. So I'm excited to dive into it. But I wanted to start our conversation with a question about your competitive dirt bike racing and being the lead singer in a punk rock band, because it's kind of interesting, and given that your diverse background from those things to now leading a top firm that helps trial lawyers and personal injury firms grow their practices, how do you think your experiences in extreme sports and even music has influenced your approach to business and leadership at SMB Team?
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, hindsight's 20/20, and as Steve Jobs said, you can't connect the dots looking forward, you can only connect them looking backward in your life, right? So how does me singing in a punk rock band have anything to do with what I do in business and how I serve law firms and dirt bike racing? I can tell you actually exactly. When I was racing dirt bikes growing up, I was very quick to realize that I was a adrenaline junkie. I mean, I needed an outlet to be able to do things that are extreme. So it actually wasn't just dirt biking. That was just my best sport, but it was mountain biking. It was snowboarding. I actually qualified for the Mountain Dew Action Sports Tour when I was like 14 years old on a snowboard. And I fell in love with dirt biking. And the weekend of the Dew Action Sports Tour, I turned it down and instead I did a dirt bike race. And that weekend, I actually shattered my leg completely in half, and my leg almost got amputated on my dirt bike. It was so close to being amputated that the doctor had already prepped my parents that I may come out of the surgery room without the bottom of my leg. And from that point, I felt like I had to create a comeback plan. And it really created this feeling of me being an underdog, because I was so talented on a dirt bike when I was young, but that injury set me back for a year and a half, 2 years. So I always felt like I had this underdog in me where I had to prove something to others. But the biggest thing I learned from dirt biking was risk-taking in entrepreneurship, because every time I make a risk in my own business, it is never as bad as coming up short on a 150-foot jump on my dirt bike. I'll get through it. That's my mindset, is because I've already broke 19 bones, both collarbones, multiple vertebrae in my back, both legs, both ACLs, multiple ribs, upper humerus, scapula, 2 times my wrist. The list goes on and on. So being that close and being a millimeter away from being paralyzed when I broke my back, being that close to life or death, nothing is as scary. So, you know, on the motocross side and extreme sports side, it taught me risk-taking. It also taught me discipline, because motocross is a really difficult, physically intensive sport. A lot of people think it's just you twist the throttle and you just kind of take off and it takes no muscle. No, it's like your heart rate when you're in the middle of a competitive pro-level race, your heart rate's averaging 160 to 170 beats a minute for, you know, 20 minutes. So that's really, really hard to sustain and to stay mentally sharp when you're jumping 100-foot jumps next to 15 other riders. So that discipline of the training kept me out of drugs. It kept me, a lot of my friends I grew up with are not in a similar situation that I am, because where I grew up was just infested with a lot of drug use. And so that's one side of it. And then the other side is the music. It taught me how to public speak, as weird as it sounds. You know, when I was on stage singing in a punk rock band, I was learning how to control and command an audience. And, you know, it's very interesting now looking at the 60,000 lawyers that we've had attend our virtual events over the last 4 years. It's funny how, you know, punk rock can go to public speaking. I never would have expected it.
Well, having watched some of your content, it's pretty damn good. And I see that you've got that confidence because you speak incredibly well when you present. So kudos for sure. I don't know that I would have the courage to get up in front of an audience. Well, I can't sing, so that's one limiter right there. But it was funny listening to you talk about the athletic side of it, because I had similar experiences growing up, because I was very competitive in cycling and raced over in Europe, went to the U.S. Nationals for my age group, and loved the sport because of the mental discipline it took to train on my own and, you know, be committed to something that didn't have a coach that, you know, was with me every day. I had someone that was coaching me, but I had to go out and do my workouts on my own. And whether I succeeded or failed depended on me having to do those things. And then later in life, getting back into racing after my kids were older and getting hit by a car and breaking every bone in my face and landing in the ICU and having to come back from that. And like you were talking about, nothing in business scares you as much as an experience like that, where, you know, ultimately it's life or death sometimes. So really resonated with me what you were talking about, because it does really translate and build that confidence as part of, you know, the entrepreneurial experience. So from this perspective, I know your background includes experience in financial analysis and digital sales. How did those techniques shape your approach to helping law firms ultimately enhance their marketing and sales and business strategies?
Yeah, well, I would say everything that I actually learned was through trial and error, unfortunately. And books, I think, were number two on the list. I think my prior experiences before I started SMB Team, I was an underwriter at Chubb, and that was the worst. That was where I learned I could never sit behind a desk all day. I went to school for risk management and insurance, and as soon as I graduated, I got a job at Chubb. And within 2 weeks after they did a one-week training, 1 week on the job, I quit. And it's kind of this entrepreneurial impulse that I don't think is teachable. I just had to. I literally had to do something on my own. So I wrote this book called Worry 180. This is where Trial by Fire started, where I wrote this book on how I overcame anxiety disorder after my family's bankruptcy. And I published the book after 8 months of writing it, launched the PayPal store, laid on my stomach. I still remember it to this day, on a pink spare room bed. I had a foreign exchange student. I was sleeping at my mom's. A foreign exchange student was staying in my bedroom because we needed some money for the rent, which was cutting down our rent. And I was sleeping in our spare bedroom in my mom's upstairs. And on my stomach, I launched the PayPal store, and then crickets. I was so excited to launch this, and no one bought the book, just crickets. And at that moment, that was when I made the best book I thought I could have possibly made on how to overcome anxiety. And I was so vulnerable in it, and it was so much practical stuff I had done to create my own mental clarity. No one bought it. And that was where my priorities focused over to learning sales and marketing, because I realized that if I can't sell the best product or service in the world, then I might as well not even create products or services, because I did it and it didn't work before. So that's then when I went to yellowpages.com and learned how to sell digital marketing, which was primarily to contractors, not lawyers. Actually, my first lawyer client was a referral from a contractor. And for some reason, the way that I was doing marketing or advising on marketing strategy for contractors for the digital division at yellowpages.com, they were getting results. So I was like, okay, there's something with the legal niche that is working better than contractors. And then that's when I decided, you know, after I became number one salesperson at yellowpages.com, I immediately quit and then started SMB team. And I was always I was a Google Ads nerd for quite some time, because I was doing my dad's marketing before that. And that's when I started realizing, holy crap, I can write an ad and immediately have that ad up and have someone click it and call a business. It was just like magic to me that you could do this and just click a button and have people calling a business in a matter of minutes, you know? So thank God I had that experience when I was working with my dad for $500 a week, sleeping at his house after my mom kicked me out and I ran out of money. Because all of these experiences laddered up to me having the raw material to at least be able to make the first couple of months of starting SMB team manageable, because I had some experience of sales, some experience of how to run Google Ads, and maybe even some experience on public speaking from, you know, the band days.
Well, it's funny, right? The road to ultimately what is successful is paved with different things that don't work. And even, you know, when anyone starts a business, there's always challenges, right? I'm sure you've experienced it, and I know all of our listeners in operating their law firms, there's always challenges that you've got to overcome. And part of the formula for success is you just keep going, right? You keep pushing till you find the right secret sauce to growing your business. It's really interesting to me that you've created a company, SMB team, that helps accelerate that for law firm. I can't imagine not taking advantage of something like that, particularly when you're a smaller firm and are looking to try and get to the next level, because doing it all on your own is always very difficult. So I wanted to ask you a few things about how you've built SMB team and the principles on that, so that hopefully our listeners will understand what exactly you guys are able to achieve in working with law firms. So I know that you've helped many law firms double their revenues in under 12 months. Are there 2 to 5 proven key strategies or tactics that have proven effective for law firms in achieving that kind of rapid growth?
Yes. We've had, in just the last year, over 100 firms who have doubled their revenues. We work with 600 firms currently. And our own company is a reflection of the model that we help our clients roll out, which is the law firm growth acceleration model. We try to practice what we preach in everything that we do. There's 4 pillars of the law firm growth acceleration model. We practice them ourselves, which is what has allowed our company to go from just me to now 130 full-time W-2, like real domestic employees for our company, not including the 100-plus freelancers that we employ full-time equivalents. It's allowed us to grow that fast, but it's also funny how all service businesses operate exactly the same, right? It's just math. So there's really four pillars, which is scalable lead generation systems, at least two of them. So that's pillar number one, a scalable lead generation. Pillar number two is an intake process that works without the owner. Pillar number three is a self-managing team, which is really two parts, which is a self-managing team recruiting process for A players and a self-managing team management process. So there's really two pillars of that. And then the last is a profit planning process, right? So, but those four pillars don't matter without what I'm going to say is the number one most important thing is the law firm owner having a vision for what their future is going to be and a clear emotional anchor to that vision, right? So, like, for me, when I started SMB Team, I didn't enter the company crossing my fingers, hoping if I do some good work for people, maybe my company will grow. No, I started the company with a 10-year Excel spreadsheet with every single year and month's revenues mapped out for 10 years. So I didn't stumble in and hope the company would grow. I said, come hell or high water, this company is going to have a $2.56 billion impact on the legal industry. I'm going to collect a 10% commission of that, and this company will do $256 million by 2026, right? And the reason, the way we're going to provide value for that is we're going to provide services under one umbrella that nobody else does, which is we want to provide law firm owners with scalable lead generation through full service marketing, scalable intake through sales training and virtual assistants to create your own basically call center and follow-up process for your firm. So you could, you know, fire your underperforming answering service, which aren't doing too hot these days. We wanted to provide those under one umbrella. We wanted to also help lawyers build a self-managing team through our law firm management process. And we wanted to also help lawyers build a profit plan, which we now have a fractional CFO, fractional COO solutions that now have all been put under one umbrella. And that vision came from an emotional anchor from my family's bankruptcy. My dad, I remember all the different vendors my dad had. He never had a centralized, solidified plan, and he certainly never had a partner or a vendor to make sense of all the available options out there, right? Like, I believe what a law firm owner needs and what my dad needed are basically the same things. Like, a really great marketing company merged with a really great intake process, merged with an amazing team that operates the firm with or without you, a self-managing team, and some experts to help you navigate the profit planning process and all the operational pitfalls that are inevitably going to pop up in scaling a firm. So I actually felt a deep desire to create these services because my dad didn't have them, my family went bankrupt, and I wanted to not only build a recession-proof business for myself, but also for every client that we work with. So most law firm owners that I talk to, when I ask them, why did you get into the law? It's like, oh, because I had a law degree. Or because I won a personal injury case when I was young and working for another attorney, and I thought, oh, maybe that's the area I know, so I'll just start my own practice in that area. And if we can reverse that narrative and start with why, like Simon Sinek talks about in his book, Why are you running the firm? What is your vision? Unleash yourself for a little bit. That's lacking for most firms. And once the vision's clear and the why is clear, then plugging in how many leads do I need to reach my revenue goal? Let's say if I could just get 100% of law firm owners clear on, I'm going to build a $10 million firm, come hell or high water. I don't care what it takes. I'm going to do it. I'm going to profit $1 million a year. Without my involvement, the firm's going to run itself, and the firm is going to be a commercially profitable enterprise that works without me. If I could just get everyone to see that, then the math becomes so crystal clear and easy to understand. Okay, I need 1,000 leads. I need to convert 20% of those leads. I need to have an average case value of X. Therefore, if I get that many leads and convert that many cases, I will be doing X million dollars a year. Then if I profit 20% of that, I will be profiting whatever that dollar amount is. And if I can build a self-managing team to run the firm without me, now this business becomes an enterprise. It becomes a sellable asset. It becomes a true net add to your net worth, right? And most lawyers don't have that. They have a solo practitioner practice or what I call a personal services corporation, which is not sellable, and it stops working when you stop working, which is what we call in today's society a job. A
lot there. The idea about a law firm operating like a business, having a strategic plan, having metrics to measure success by, is something that they don't teach in law school. You know, I went to law school, practiced law, still have a law firm, but you don't learn anything about those things. And I think there's been, at least in probably the older guard, a mentality around it's a practice, not really a business. But it's so beautiful what you've talked about, because ultimately I think things are changing and people that are involved in the practice are realizing that maybe they can't do this the old way because that practice mentality doesn't produce the kind of results that you're talking about. And if you don't have other guests on that talked about they've become the CEO of their law firm, they're no longer the one practicing law, they're managing their firm as a business, or someone hires someone to fulfill those roles. I'm curious, because you talked about all of these things about components, what's your view on that? Because I know the law firm growth acceleration model has been remarkably successful for the law firms that you work with. I think I saw in my doing my research that it's 81% growth in revenues. Are law firms able to do that without creating some scalability, or is that part of what you talk about in terms of how they manage their practices?
Yeah, I think you just probably asked the biggest question that goes through an attorney's mind when the concept of growth is presented to them. And it ultimately comes down to, I think, two things. It's, what do you mean I'm a practitioner? Like, what do you mean replace myself? Or, I don't want to do that if it's going to harm my client results, right? It's either one of those two things. And they kind of piggyback off of one another, because that comes from the belief that you are the only person that can provide legal services to your client. And there's, what, 1.9 million lawyers in just the United States? So, okay, if you truly think you are statistically, there is a chance that you are statistically the best lawyer in the United States. But the chances are pretty low. I mean, just one out of 1.9 million, that's what, similar to lottery level? So I think the chances you're not the best lawyer. And that's just the overwhelming statistical likelihood, right? So as soon as that ego hit gets swallowed and accepted, right, then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, great, what is my role? Well, if you are such a great attorney, then do you want the impact that you have on your local marketplace in your practice area? Let's say you're a Chicago personal injury lawyer. Do you want your Chicago personal injury impact to be limited by your personal bandwidth? Do you believe in so strongly in the other personal injury lawyers in Chicago that you're willing to let them steal all your cases, that you're willing to let them mishandle your clients, right? I hope not, because in most cases, there are so many not good attorneys in every market, and I believe it's every attorney's ethical duty and obligation to spread their great lawyering through a team. So it just, all it requires is a shift of me doing the work to me coaching a team to be the best at my methodology. But you're still in the same role, right? And you can still have a couple cases you handle yourself. It's not a black or white thing. I always say, like, the key to a self-sustaining business is the owner is able to do things that are only in their sweet spot. Only in their sweet spot. What's that mean? If you love handling cases, okay, great. You build your firm around you being able to pick and choose the exact types of cases, because let's be honest, it's not every single case that you like handling. It's a specific type of case that you like handling, if that is truly the case, right? And you're going to design your firm around handpicking the three or four cases a year that you want to personally handle. And then the rest is a system through your legal operating system, your team that you train on best practices, on your methodology, they handle the rest. Because you know that if they're following your methodology, it's going to be better than the competitors in the market. So you're doing your market a greater service by making yourself multipliable, right? Instead of just hoarding it all for yourself. And by the way, if you get sick, what happens to your clients, right? If you get sick and, you know, you for some reason aren't able to practice law anymore, what happens to your law firm? What happens to your asset, which in most cases is the number one thing tied to your net worth, the business you're owning is usually the biggest tie. What happens to all this stuff? And are you thinking so much about yourself that you're not thinking about your family? Like, what life do you want to give your family? If you're working 80 hours a day, which isn't possible, but most lawyers make it possible, if you're working so crazily much, are you deluding yourself that you have to do it all yourself, you know? Because I don't do much. I mean, now that, you know, I am truly in, I'm not even in the CEO role, I'm really in the owner role, because we really have four categories. Well, there's actually eight categories. Every lawyer starts out as a law student. That's where you pay to learn. The next level up is you become a lawyer working for someone else. That's where you get paid to learn, right? But you're working for someone else. Then you take the leap. You become a solo practitioner. You start your own firm. That's where over 80% of law firm owners are, is zero employees, right? That's the practitioner trap. You tell yourself the myth, oh, I'm working for myself now. Lie. That's not true. You're now on call for your clients. And if you hire one or two helpers, you're on call for them. You still have no freedom, right? So the myth of entrepreneurship is not really met at that level, which then brings you to the next level. This is a solo practitioner who tried to expand their firm. This is what we call small business manager. Small business manager is someone with 3 to 19 employees with no core leadership processes, no clear systems, and they got a couple good lead generation systems in place, like a referral system, maybe one inbound system, and then they start scaling their firm, their head spins off, and then they go, oh, I'm going to go back to when it was just me. And they hit a ceiling of complexity, they go backwards, then they just tread water at solo. And then a select few lawyers cross what we call the abyss, and they travel to the uncharted territory, which is law firm CEO and law firm owner. Law firm CEO is where instead of you being on call for clients and a small team, you now work for a vision and a leadership team. That's when you're a CEO. Right? You're no longer on call for clients. You're no longer on call for your team. You work for a vision and a leadership team, but you're still the active CEO. You're still the active manager of the business. And so you replace yourself, like kind of Warren Buffett has done in almost all of his businesses that he owns. He invests in them. He is a owner of Coca-Cola. He's not the doer in Coca-Cola, right? So he makes 20 times more than the CEO of Coca-Cola doing none of the day-to-day work. That's because he's an owner slash investor, right? That's the next category where you become the owner of a commercial profitable enterprise that works without you, business, and not the doer. So you hire a COO or a CEO to run the firm without you. And then that frees you up to then be either a freedom entrepreneur or an expansion entrepreneur, which either you optimize your life for work-life balance or you optimize your life for industry expansion. Taking your proven model and duplicating it across geographic areas or more practice areas. And then the last level is what we call wealth multiplier. This is where instead of you working hard for money, your money works hard for you. This is where you now become an angel investor. You buy other businesses. Maybe you're investing in real estate. You have external investments where your money is making you more money. Most lawyers never get to that place. And what's really interesting, I've interviewed probably 30 law firm owners that are doing over $100 million a year in fees. It's insane. And they all have one thing in common. They're in that owner-investor category. They're investing in other businesses. They're not really needed in much of their day-to-day of the firm. They're, you know, maybe they do a big ad here and there to, you know, for their offline strategy or their TV strategy or their social media strategy just to be the face. That's it, though. They're making a couple key decisions, and they're trusting their lieutenants. It all stems from trust. If you don't trust that other people can do great work, good luck building a company, and even better luck building a company with a positive culture. Because if you're the smartest person in your company, that ain't going to be a fun culture. People don't like to feel like they're not smart and not valued because everything needs to run through the head honcho. Like, as soon as I sold my IQ points, I became a much better entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's some phenomenal advice. And it's interesting hearing you talk about those things, because the people that I've had on the podcast as guests who have gotten to that CEO, entrepreneur, business type of mentality, there's such a select group. But it is, to me, where it seems like the younger generation, their heads are more at versus what has been traditionally the model. And I wonder if, you know, what's going on just with the internet has been a change of force multiplier because of what you can do electronically. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because I know that you wrote a book about PPC for lawyers, not dummies, and you talked about the WAM method, and I was just wondering, those things, how does that play into the landscape and the need for differing approaches than to what used to be the model?
Yeah, I think the question underlying the question that you're asking is, what has to work without the owner? And the two main things is sales and casework. And if you peel beneath that, you'll understand that, in my viewpoint, how do I replace the owner needing to be involved in the sales process of signing up a new client or attracting a new client? How do I replace the owner in the actual delivery of the casework? We already discussed that. Train a team on how to use your methodology and pick your 3-4 cases a year. On the how do I replace myself in sales side, the first place to start is scalable lead generation, which ties into what you're saying is, how do I make, yes, word of mouth is important. If I were to ask a room of 100 attorneys, 70 to 80% of the room is going to say word of mouth and referrals is their lifeblood. I mean, that's just how it is. Maybe even higher in some rooms, depending on practice area. That is not a good thing from a business perspective. It's not scalable. You know, most referral word of mouth strategies are not scalable. Now, there are cases where people have created unique messaging around their referral strategy, and they have a scheduled delivery mechanism through email marketing and newsletters and a pre-crafted referral strategy that actually is a predictable word-of-mouth strategy. That is not the case for 99.99999% of law firms. It's just, oh, Joe Schmo called. He has this type of case. It's not really in my core practice area, but what am I going to do? I mean, I don't have leads coming from anywhere else. So people build these unconscious practices because they're depending on the word of mouth trap, as I call it. Instead, create a scalable lead generation system that gives you enough volume of leads that you can sift through and design your practice consciously without you having to shake hands and kiss babies. So that then starts with reverse engineering. Okay, well, if I need to create a scalable lead generation system, I really have a couple options. I have offline and I have online. Okay, what's the barrier to entry in offline? Millions of dollars in most cases. And you can do hyper-local offline, but it's risky because you're dealing with a low number of impressions, right? This is stuff like, you know, sponsoring local baseball, you know, places and like very local, you know, offline stuff. Okay, you can get some cases there, right? But most of it is a barrier to entry for TV, radio, billboards, right? So then that pulls you over to online. We all know online is way more targeted. We know that's where the eyeballs are going. I mean, let alone the billboards you pass by on the road. Most people are staring at their phones or not even looking up. You know, they're already distracted with their phone. So social media is where people's attention is going, right? So if we reverse engineer from that, we go, okay, well, great. I want to create a scalable practice. How am I going to use either social media or Google? Because those are the two buckets. We have demand advertising and we have awareness advertising. Demand is getting in front of people when they're searching for you. So that would be like Google. That would be like legal directories, like, you know, which I don't recommend all of them, but some do work in some practice areas, in some geographic areas. It's not a blanket thing, though. AVO works great in one practice area for one geographic area, but that doesn't mean it works for the opposite side of the United States for a completely different practice. It's all a crapshoot, right? That's why we always have to stay testing for this stuff. The most predictable way is Google for demand advertising. So there's really three prongs of crushing Google. You have your local services ad strategy. Those are the ads that show up at the very, very top of Google. Then you have, which are like the Google guaranteed ads. Now, in personal injury, that's a crapshoot in a lot of cases because it's become so competitive. There's some markets where you can set a $100,000 a day budget and your ad won't even get served. So it's just like the algorithm is so wacky now with local services ads, which then leads us to the next prong of Google, which is search ads. So these are just your traditional search ads, the old school Google ads, right? And then the last is Google Maps, right? And Google Maps is where the highest intent people on the organic side go. Below Google Maps is usually not worth an attorney's time. This is where you're going to see those third-party directories showing up, people with multi-million dollar budgets. It's better to compete for Maps and above for Google, right? So you can use the WAM method to do that, right? The word alignment marketing method, which basically means you need to do keyword analysis. You need to understand what are the exact words that my target client types in. Okay, let's say I target maritime accidents, right? Well, you could just bid on maritime injury lawyer, right, as a niche of personal injury and then say, oh, that's a day. That's the words my clients type in, right? Someone who's a little bit more sharp in marketing would go, what niches of maritime are the best niches for me to type? And what are phrases that only someone who is injured on a cruise ship would type in? And brainstorm them out. By the way, all these answers are in the attorney's head. The problem is the attorney is not giving themselves enough time to work on CEO level stuff. And therefore, they're falling victim to every marketing company they hire when they should be leading their marketing strategy, right? You know your niche better than any marketing company you hire, including us. That's why we want to be partners with our clients. We don't want to tell you, here's what you need to do for maritime act. No, there's nuances in every market. There's specific laws. There's different ways people express things in every market. Our job is to give you the data. Hey, here's what we've seen on all the maritime campaigns we've ran on the $100 million a year we spend for attorneys. Here's what we've seen work. Okay, great. Now let's apply it to Southeast Texas. All right. So let's see this. Okay. Is there a big population of cruise ships here? Like, and what about the offshore oil rigs? What about this? And how much, what percent do you want to be? This is why attorneys say, Google doesn't work. No, no, no. Google is the number one highest traffic website in the world. More eyeballs go to Google than any other website in the world. People search for things on Google. Therefore, it's just the quality of your strategy that did or didn't work on Google. That's going to be what determines whether you succeed on SEO or your Google advertising strategy, is basically you having the right strategy of what buckets of words that you want to target, right? And then your messaging, the word alignment marketing method, means the words your clients type in and the words you put out in your advertising match, right? So when someone types in some nuanced variation of a cruise ship injury and they come and see your landing page, your website, they go, wow, this person's a cruise ship expert. Oh my God, I have to call them right now, right? And that marriage is what creates scalable lead generation, where people will call you so warmed up, ready to close because they feel that it's their need has been met, right? And then the other side is social media. So social media is harder than Google, but it's less expensive per lead. So it's a trade-off, right? Why? The variable on Google is basically whether you set up the right targeting. The variable on social media is could be limitless things. It could be your personality. It could be, unfortunately or realistically, your skin color, your accent. If you make social media videos and you want to put ads behind those are all variables. Like it or not, if somebody has the same script in Arkansas for a personal injury ad on social media and someone uses that same script in Maine, probably not going to work, right? And then there's the variable of the attorney themselves and how they deliver it and how the video was filmed, right? That's why what we've gravitated towards on social media is creating AI avatars. We have our clients create an artificial intelligence avatar of themselves where they film themselves talking for 2.5 minutes. That then encodes all their facial expressions or vocal tonality, and then we actually plug in the script and the background for them so that we're able to split test at a better scale. Because if an ad doesn't work on social media for an attorney, then they have to go refilm another ad, and that's more time that you'll never get back. So social media ads is what we've seen work the best. I'm great friends with Top Dog, who's become one of the largest volume. He was my first employee at SMB Team and very close friend. We went to high school, middle school, and elementary school together. And I've interviewed Mike Mandel, Law by Mike, probably 15 times, CEO lawyer, maybe 5 times, 6 times. I've talked to all these people, and the bottom line is the most signed cases come from ads on social media, not organic. So if you want to build a 1 million-person following, that's great for branding. It's not great for case acquisition. You're better off using ads because you can choose your geographic radius on ads instead of just crapshoot. Let's say we have a client who did a DUI video of this college athlete who got arrested for DUI, and his name is Derek Martin. He's a client of ours. And he created this video. It went viral on YouTube. It got millions of views, but the views were from all states where he couldn't serve people because he's in Chicago, right? So no cases came from that video, right? But he got millions of views, and it was cool to show his friends. Better off just doing a targeted ad campaign on the same topic, just showing that ad in Chicago so you can actually serve the people who see your ad. And then you can do demographic filters. You can show it to just these age brackets or people who have these interests, people who are in these household income brackets, so that it's more likely that you're showing your ads to people who can actually hire you.
So the key is niching when you're talking about the Google search words, and then key strategies that you deploy for advertising on social media, it sounds like, from what you just described.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And I would say niching is the most important thing for both of them. Choosing the right niche within a niche, right? So it's not just car accidents. It's car accidents for fathers, car accidents for moms, car accidents for this niche population, right? That is what's missing in most internet marketing.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, certainly the niching idea is great for business, right? You guys specialize in serving a population. So do we. You know, we just work with plaintiff personal injury law firms that are looking for an outsourcing partner who can handle healthcare lien resolution. Having that small targeted messaging and way of approaching the market narrows the focus and also laser focuses you on bringing in the right type of business.
It's so true.
So I wanted to ask you about your new book, Law Firm Growth Accelerator, because I got a sneak peek at the table of contents and I saw it was broken into 3 parts, and it makes sense with what you talked about with the law firm growth acceleration model, but the parts were organized, plan your profit, growing your firm, and self-managing a team. I'm curious, like, why did you ultimately organize it like that? And you've talked about these different parts, but what are key takeaway concepts that a personal injury lawyer who's listening to this should have at the top of their mind?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, of organizing the book the way we did, what everyone wants is not necessarily what they need, right? The topics that we knew would be most popular are actually embedded within part two of the book, which is called Growing Your Firm. That's where we give everything on awareness marketing, demand marketing, and then intake. The reason we didn't want to lead with that, even though it's probably the most popular content in the book, is because I refuse for someone to implement law firm growth techniques like what we teach in the book without having a vision or a plan that they're executing to, because it's just chaos. And I've seen it happen too many times where people just get focused on growth. They don't have a personal plan or a law firm growth plan in place before that. And then they look at the budget that it's going to take for them to grow their firm. And they, I can't spend that. What do you mean? You said you want to go to $5 million a year. It's going to take 20% of that on marketing to get there. So what's more important, saving money or your dream? Right? And that's not happening for most lawyers when they go into growth technique. So we put planning your profit first as the compass point, then how to grow your firm, because most lawyers, let's face it, aren't where they want to be in terms of growth. They're not running a big enough firm. And they also have a ton of head trash around, if I grow my firm, my life's going to get harder. Not true. A $10 million firm is way easier to run than a $1 million firm. Way easier. You'll have an executive team at that level. You'll be profiting $1.5 to $2 million a year. That's serious capital that you could take home. You could reinvest in the firm's growth. You can hire new executives. You could spend millions on advertising. And life is so much easier when you run a bigger firm if you have the right information. So that's why growing your firm is next after the vision setting and the planning your profit. And then it's about creating a self-managing team, because it really works like this. You pour some fuel on the fire. You get more leads. You sign more cases. And then, alert, I got busy. Now I need to hire more people. Now I need to manage more people. So it really works in order where it's like you set your vision, you plan your profit, then you create a growth plan, and then you force yourself into creating a self-managing team by expanding and better managing your team without your day-to-day involvement. So that's kind of like the overall structure. The biggest thing I would say is like an actionable takeaway for every single person listening. My desperate, desperate, literal begging is that you create a vivid vision for your firm. A vivid vision. It's a 3-year PDF document that clearly states where your law firm will be in revenues, profits, team size. I want you to envision everything. How's the press talking about you? How many effortless 5-star reviews are you getting every month because of the world-class service your firm's providing? What's your marketing budget at that point? How many leads are you generating? Like, see what that is and document it. We have a step-by-step process in the book on exactly how to brainstorm out the vision, how to bucket it into separate buckets, and then how to ultimately put that into a Word document, send it to a graphic designer, and create a graphic designed, documented one single place of your vision. Because if you don't know where you're going, I guarantee your team is going to experience more turnover. I guarantee your marketing is not going to work as well. I guarantee you're just not going to stick through as much adversity as someone who does have a clear vision. That would be my desperate scream from the mountaintops. There's a book on this. If you don't want to read our book, great. There's another book called Vivid Vision by Cameron Harold, who coached me personally for 3 years. I had him as a one-on-one coach, former COO of 1-800-GOT-JUNK. He wrote the book on it. Just follow his book. Don't even read our book. Just go create a vivid vision. That's my begging wish for everyone.
Love it. Yeah, your team has no idea unless you build that vision and make sure it's integrated into the culture. That's something that's been so near and dear to my heart. But I love the way you laid out the book, because that idea of visioning, having a growth plan, and then scalability, once you start achieving that growth, to make sure that you're not losing your mind and it works for you. That's such a beautiful framework for any type of entrepreneur. But I think for law firms, it's something that just isn't talked about much, because it is that old guard mentality, but it's changing. And I think that's a really really important set of things for a law firm owner to be thinking about in terms of how to achieve that kind of growth, which clearly it works because the firms you're working with are growing at impressive rates.
Yeah, and I love the word you just used, law firm owner, not doer.
Yep. Something I came across in doing the research for the podcast really resonated with me, which is you talked about the importance of changing status quo and being the best version of yourself. Because I believe as a leader, it's my duty to be the best version of myself here at Synergy, but also with my family, and that's my internal commitment. I'm curious about those types of values and how that influences your work with law firms, particularly in helping them innovate and dominate their markets. How does all of that factor into how you coach and help firms with that kind of thought process?
So we have a core value at our company called Be the Bar. So a lot of people say set the bar high, right? To me, that's always been a temporary action, right? For me to set the bar high once doesn't guarantee I'm always going to set the bar high. I'm going to always up my game, right? So what we practice is be the bar, right? Be the standard. Be the identity of someone who is always upping what you did in the past. And this isn't a comfortable belief for law firm owners. This is a relentless pursuit to growth personally, professionally, financially, for your team, for your family. And I believe continual growth and being the best version of yourself is how you build a world-class culture. I think it's very fascinating to me. One of the biggest excuses that I hear from lawyers is there's no good people out there. I can't hire great attorneys. I can't hire great support staff. There's no good people. It's so hard to find great people. Okay, I have no problem finding great people. Why can someone say that they have such a hard time and someone else not? Does Elon Musk have problems finding great people? Did Steve Jobs? No. And it's because they are so insatiably driving themselves to grow that they attract people who are in the same boat. And they create such a splash in their market, right, that people desire to work for them or work with them, right? It's not just like you put up a job ad and excellent people go, oh, wow, I can't believe that job ad. I'm going to quit my high-paying job because all great people are already employed, and I'm going to join this company because of a job ad. What? No. It's everything but the job ad that makes someone want to join your company. It's your content. It's your approach to constantly innovating your legal services such a way where it just is known that you are a force to be reckoned with. I mean, that is ultimately, if a business is a compilation of people, it's that simple, like Richard Branson said. Business is simply a group of people working towards a goal. Okay, if that's true, then isn't it also true that the quality of your business would then just be the quality of your people? Just like a sports team, very rare that the best players aren't on a team that wins the Super Bowl, right? So this pursuit to constant growth is your best advertising mechanism for where you want to go. But if you're not growing, if you're complacent, if it's all about you and your personal income and, you know, reaching your own personal definition of freedom, that's all important to have as motivators. Who the hell is going to work for that? Oh, I'm working for John because he's trying to make $1 million a year. I'm working for John because he's looking to take a vacation this year. No, we need to zoom out our vision and make it about the impact we want to have on our market and enroll people in that. And that's not happening in many legal firms, but that will happen if you commit yourself to constant growth.
Yeah, it goes back to the vision and mission and tying all that together with the why, right? It's incredibly important, and I'm very passionate with our team about our why, you know, and our why has to do with helping injured parties and their families by making sure that we protect their net recovery from claims by lien holders. And it's we go through examples of how that has helped the injured party, and then how in turn we help that law firm by removing a administrative task from their staff and getting this great result for the client. All those things are so important, so everybody knows why they come in each day to sit at their desk. It's to help that next person, that next family, and being a great partner to the law firms we get the opportunity to serve. And it is, without that, people don't have anything to anchor what they're doing to something bigger than just, I got to write this email, or I got to, you know, I got to do this, I got to do that. It becomes, there's just meaningless. I wanted to ask you last, I know that you're a mindfulness guy and you meditate like me. I'm curious, how does that influence your view as a law firm growth accelerator? That's deliberately very open-ended because I wanted to give you the ability to talk about whatever you want as we close out today's episode.
So after meditating for, 10 years, what I found is, it's funny, you can meditate for 10 years and all it gives you is a half a second of a pause in everything you do. It's very fascinating to me. And for me, mindfulness is the ability to be aware of your thoughts and your sensations in real time in the present moment. So without resistance. So to be able to have a thought pop up, to see that thought, smirk at it, and be unaffected by it, and to be able to feel an emotion like anxiety. An emotion I get a lot is like a compulsion emotion to do something immediately because I'm very action-oriented. So to be able to see those emotions and to let them ride, I believe, sharpen your ability as a leader to separate yourself from knee-jerk reactions and to always ask yourself, what is the right long-term decision in this situation? Because oftentimes we make short-term decisions at the expense of long-term results. But we don't care because we're just constantly chasing the short-term gratification. For me, I had to fix that. So what I try to do is every time I have a decision, which in essence should be that's the main role of the CEO, is to make decisions, to make executive decisions that typically include a financial underpinning. The ability to make decisions, if that is your role, then your quality of decisions will determine the quality of your results. So if I'm making a marketing decision, the mindful approach is to wait until I have the whole story, comprehensive data on every single analytic point, every thing that we're running, get the full story, bring back to, okay, what is our overall mission? What is our overall KPI that we're looking to reach? What's the data say? And then at the intersection of where we're going and what the data says, somewhere in the middle, there's going to be a solution. And if we could practice that as CEOs of our practices, imagine how amazing that is. Like, you're the CEO of a practice. A problem pops up and you're not the one handling cases anymore, but you have a team of 10 people who are. Okay, problem popped up. We had two clients complain about the same thing. Data. Is that enough data? If you have 2,000 clients, no, that's not enough data. So, okay, two clients complained about X. I want to see a bigger sample size. Why is this happening? And is this actually a root cause? Okay, data collection. Where are we going? Okay, well, our goal is to provide world-class service to all of our clients by revolutionizing their da-da-da-da-da, and our KPI is we want to deliver 2 times the average result for our clients in half the time by blah, 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 blah. Okay, great. Here's where we're going. Here's what the data says. What is my decision in this case? Okay. It seems like we need a better client communication system to get clients to treatment more consistently. So now my priority as a CEO is, okay, I'm going to roll out a new client communication system with my team to get to increase the KPI of the percent of clients attending treatment in a timely manner. That's the decision making that, like, when I started in business, it was none of that. It was holy shit, this isn't working, need to fix this, alert, constantly, all the time. And I wish, looking back, I didn't make so many knee-jerk reactions. And that's what, over time, mindfulness has taught me, is make the right long-term decision by revisiting where you're going and what the data says. And that takes a lot of discipline. It's often harder when you're a high performer, like most attorneys are. It's often harder to not take action than it is to take a ton of disorganized actions.
Yeah, great. Great advice. So if any of our listeners are interested in working with SMB team, can you talk briefly about what you can do for them and the best way for them to get in contact with you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think the best way is obviously the book. The book is going to give you the entire blueprint of way more than you would ever get talking to anyone at our team, just because it's 580 pages. Put it this way, it took us 14 hours to read the book, the audiobook. So hopefully none of my people on my team talk that long. So that's probably your best route, is getting the book, Law Firm Growth Accelerator, audiobook as well, which myself and my partner, Andy Stickle, we read the whole thing. My voice still hurts from that. The second is to go to SMB team, that's small, medium business team.com. And on there, you can book a 360 analysis with our team. And we'll actually walk you through the four prongs of the Law Firm Growth Acceleration Model. And we'll help you find bottlenecks in the firm around lead generation, intake, your team, and your profit planning process. And we'll help you and advise you on a plan, whether that's with or without us, to fix one or all four of those areas of the Growth Acceleration Model if you book a 360 analysis.
Awesome. For the book, is it available on Amazon, or what's the best place for listeners to get a copy? Yeah.
It is, but we give more bonuses if you buy the book through our funnels than if you buy it through Amazon. Amazon's kind of a ripoff, so we're trying to – yeah, but you can buy it on Amazon, no problem. I just want you to get the book.
Well, we'll make sure we link to the right place for you guys to get the book and all of Bill's contact information and links to SMB team. Bill, thanks for joining me today on Trial Lawyer View. It's been great to have you.
Thank you so much for the time.
This was another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoyed today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.